Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Today's Zero Block 30 is brought to you by the good folks at Fuego Box. Fuego Box goes out once a month, and it's a premium set of all kinds of hot sauces. So whether you're like a normal Sriracha dude, a Frank's guy, whatever, Tabasco, these sauces taste amazing. I'm not usually a hot sauce guy because you guys know I've had diarrhea since Easter of 2007.
It's true.
And every time the box gets dropped off at my house, my wife looks at me with sheer terror in her eyes because she knows I'm going to unleash hell on the bathroom. But that's what I'll go through if the hot sauce is good. Because if the hot sauce is trash, I'm not going to go through that. But I'll light my butthole literally on fire for some Fuego Box. So instead of just adding pure heat to your food, the sauces in Fuego Box bring a lot of added flavor with a nice kick. It's hard for me to eat my breakfast tacos without this stuff now. They sent us a few sample boxes, and they are absolutely incredible. Stoolies, you guys get a 10% off discount code. Just go to fuegobox.com, use the promo code CHAPS, C-H-A-P-S, and get $10 off your first box. Let's do it. Zero Block 30 time. How we doing, gentlemen?
Oh, we're doing real good this week. We're doing real good this week.
We're doing great. Oh, Khan's having the week of his life, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think... When was the first time you really sobered up, Cons? Has it happened yet?
No, not really, because Monday I went to another Christmas party that evening. I mean, Sunday night I went to a Christmas party, then Monday, so maybe Tuesday-ish.
See, I feel like you're too old to be having that kind of drinking binge, because it usually catches up to me. Once you stop drinking, I think once January 4th, rolls around, you are absolutely fucked.
Well, Connor, aren't you one of those guys that you're like, I don't get hungover? That's not a thing.
Yeah, and that's not to sound like a hardo. I just, for whatever reason, my body chemistry, I wake up and I don't feel hungover. I don't get headaches. I don't get stomach pains.
Does that whole thing go back to your mindset that you can like mentally out tough like how drunk you are, how hungover you are? Like, you think if you keep saying that, you'll just never get hungover, even though you might be hungover?
Maybe, but I think the two are separate from one another. I think it's two different things. I think it's really just luck of the Irish. I think it is something to do with my heritage.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I can wake up a morning after being at the bar all night and feel fine and go about my day as if nothing happened.
No, I've seen it. I've gotten texts from you Sunday morning after a huge Saturday night being like, hey, you ready?
And
I'm like,
yeah.
No, I'm a dead person. I'm not ready.
So
yeah, that's how I am. Whenever I have a strong night, because I like to kick back on some few Oaks and Cokes, I've been known to partake in some adult beverages, but when I've had too many, my wife usually gets up before me, like no matter what, every day. She's up at like 6:30 every day just doing her thing because she's a little busybody. But when I walk out of my bedroom, she'll be like, good God almighty, you look like a dead person. Go take a shower.
That's how I am. It's just like my whole, everything about me is like, oh, that guy's hungover as fuck today.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, but the party Saturday night after the big win over Navy went into the wee hours of the morning, and I just kept it going all day Sunday.
So let's kind of walk the people through what it's like to go to an Army-Navy game. Connor, you played in the game, so you had a good idea what it was going to be like, what the atmosphere was going to be like. But Riggs, you were in the same boat as me, where this is your first time going. Walk us through some of the high points, some of the low points, what you thought of it.
I would say just seeing the tradition, seeing all of the cadets all geared up on one side versus the sea of midshipmen on the other side. Again, everybody's geared up. Everybody's in unison. It was cool. It was cooler even than I thought it was going to be. Obviously, it helped that, you know, we were able to get on the field and be like right on the sidelines, which I had never been for a big event like that. But I think that it truly was kind of a bucket list thing if you're a sports fan. Seeing that kind of rivalry, which is so much different than just typical college rivalries, it was awesome. It was really awesome to be a part of it. I'm going to tell people forever, like, I was there when Army finally beat Navy. It was sick.
Yeah, and shout to Mike, our buddy over at Army, for taking care of us and getting us on the field. That was great for us. And as Dave mentioned on the rundown the other day, you know, I got a little excited after that first fumble, but that's just how I am at Army games. And I had to get bundled up by a Baltimore City police officer. Shout out to that guy.
If you're listening and you don't watch the rundown, so what happened is, I'll set the table here for a little bit. So it's me, Dave Portnoy, and Big Cat, Riggs, Connor, and John Kelly was on the sidelines.
Our camera
guy. We're watching the game go by, and we had just watched the pageantry. You have the parachuters flying down. You have the Army Chief of Staff out on the field. You have all the guys marching on. You have an incredible national anthem. You could just see on two sides of the field all the Naval Academy cadets. And if you look directly to your right, you could see all the Army guys from West Point. And it was incredible. So the entire place is fucking electric. And they're just ready to go. On the very first drive, Navy fumbles the ball. And the entire Corps of Cadets loses their minds. Like, to a whole new level of nothing I've seen at a sporting event. Like, they are all dressed the same. And so it just gives it a different look and feel altogether. Because you have lots of student sections that go nuts. I mean, like at Wisconsin, when they play jump around, like, you'll have that kind of experience. It's a whole different ball game when everybody's dressed the same and in uniform. So Connor taking the ability to be on the sideline for the first time as like a fan, really, at an Army-Navy game, loses his shit and jumps out on the field. And this older gentleman, who is a police officer, who's there for sideline security, takes Connor, grabs him up close to him, kind of like if you could imagine what Denzel Washington would look like if he was the Denzel Washington from Training Day.
Yeah,
what he would look like if he was a Baltimore police officer on the sideline. And just brings him in and just kind of whispers to him, if you do that again, I'm going to choke slam you, and then I'm going to kick your ass out of the stadium. It's just so quiet and so perfect. And it kind of reminded me of what happens at boot camp whenever a drill instructor is kind of doing something fucked up to you. Like, they'll be like, I want you to scream as silently as you can. And it just, you're like, wait, what the fuck did he say?
That's exactly what it was.
Scream as silently as you can, motherfucker. And that's basically what the Baltimore police officer did to Connor. And it sobered Connor up real quick because he didn't want to get kicked out. He actually wanted to witness the game. And it ended up being incredible. The atmosphere was outrageous.
Yeah, no. So that was real special for me to be on the sidelines, as you mentioned, as a fan at that point. So I can only imagine how special that was for you guys to experience it that close to it, because the emotion was palpable in the stadium. And I mean, maybe I'm biased here, but I kind of sensed in the air that everyone kind of felt like maybe something different was going to happen this year. I mean, did you guys get that feeling?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think you could get that early on. And I think just to go back, too, to all the pageantry, I mean, the way those parachute guys came in, they came in hot,
yeah,
too. And I was just like, wow. And all the way that to the national anthem, to all the different people that we met, like Army Chief of Staff and all that. Again, you realize very quickly, like, this is different. This is different than a football game. Like, this is the military. And then, like you said, pretty quickly early on in the game, you could tell, like, this game is different. This is going to be wild. Even if it wasn't going to go Army's way, you knew, like, this is going to come down to the wire. And so it kept you plugged
there,
in the whole time.
And there was definitely a point in the fourth quarter when Navy took the lead, and I was standing, like, right by the back pylon, and Navy took the lead, and you go over, and the Navy confidence and the student section just shot through the roof. And you could feel it on the Army side, like, oh, fuck, here we go again.
Here it comes, right, absolutely.
But then Army bounced back and got it. And being in between, really not even just being on the sideline, but being in the end zone between the two student sections where you could walk 30 feet left or right and feel the electricity on both sides, it was incredible.
Great. Yeah, that third and fourth quarter, it was like a volley going back and forth.
It was. It was awesome. And, like, I was trying to get footage, and it was great because you didn't have to go far. You go 30 feet, like Chaps is saying, 30 feet one way, and it's – this crowd's going nuts. And then 30 feet the other way, and they were, like, depressed because they just gave up a touchdown. So it was awesome. And then when the when the game was over, I was standing in the Army – between the Army fan section and the field – and people were, I mean, I'm surprised I'm still alive because they stormed the field. These guys are jumping over, like, the railing, which is a good 10, 15 feet high to begin with.
Yeah.
And they were jumping over the railing. I thought somebody was going to kill me. But we were out there in the middle of the field with them going nuts. And it was awesome. It was a great scene.
Yeah, I mean, when they scored to go up 17-14, there was a knot in my stomach. But I was confident, having watched us play all year, I was confident that with 12 minutes left, we were going to score. But it was like, until they did score, that knot didn't go away. And then we scored, and then we stopped them, and then we were taking a knee to win the game. And there was about a minute left, and I knew it was finally over. I put my hands in the air, and I started to cry. I was extremely emotional. And then I just happened to run into a bunch of my buddies, a bunch of my teammates on the field singing the alma mater. It was a really, really special day for me. So I was really happy that you guys were able to see something so special. Because, honestly, I don't think that would have been as enjoyable if Navy had won. Certainly, it's still the pageantry and everything and the motion would have been there. But I think the fact that we won and you guys were able to see us break that streak made it just a little bit more special.
No, and it's one of those games that even if both teams were 0-10 coming into it, when whichever side wins, we'll be crying afterwards. It means so much. It's just, it's different than anything else. And you could feel the whole time.
You hear that a lot on Rivalry Week, which is usually the last week of November for most of college football, except for this game. And you hear that, oh, as long as we win this one, I don't really think it matters. I really feel like that's the case with Army and Navy. They would not give a fuck what happened the rest of the season. You're riding high because it's essentially like a bowl game. It really is a bowl game.
Yeah. It's almost like our national championship every year. And it was just something very special this year.
So before we went down there, we had the opportunity to interview a guy who is going through school at Pensacola right now, and he is a naval grad. He's a grad from the Naval Academy and a brand new ensign. And so we're going to bring him on the show. He was feeling pretty confident that Navy was going to win. I kind of wish we had him on now so Connor could bust his balls a little bit, but we'll bring him on now. So enjoy this interview. All right, well, this time on Zero Block 30, we have a guest who is a recent graduate of the Naval Academy, and he's currently going through flight school at Pensacola. Welcome to Zero Block 30, Ensign Pat. How are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, man, thanks for coming on. So whenever you reached out to us and you said that you had a story, the story that I was super interested in, not to say that going to flight school and all that shit is cool, but you have a buddy who has a pretty amazing claim to fame, right?
Yes, he does. So don't want to disappoint you here, but so my friend, big shout out to my man Mike, he graduated with 420 demerits, which is the Naval Academy record. But little did the last time he got in trouble, he passed 400, which is the limit before you get kicked out.
Oh.
So what they didn't realize that until 6 months later. So they told They actually called him in and said, "Hey, you're over the limit by 20 demerits. So we're just going to let you slide. But if you get one more, you're done."
Wow! And how close to graduating was he?
Oh, he got in trouble. He got over the limit, I think, junior year.
So, oh my God! And did he graduate?
He graduated, but he did not commission. He actually found out he had a heart murmur, so he couldn't really.
What a wild ride. And I think that a big part of this is important that our listeners will like to know. Whose record did he break?
John McCain.
John McCain, man. The senator from Arizona who was the presidential candidate was the all-time demerit king at the Naval Academy for a long time, right? Like, it's like 40 years?
Quite a while. Something like that.
Any record that stands for 40 years is pretty damn good.
Yeah, it's certainly impressive.
That's something.
And Pat, back up just a little bit, and you know, obviously I think everyone can understand what a demerit is. At West Point, we have what's called hours, but can you just go a little bit more detail into how you get a demerit? What does a demerit mean? What is then, if you have one demerit, what does that mean? What do you do as punishment? And just get into that whole system.
Okay, so when you get in trouble, you go through the adjudication system. For conduct offenses, you get straight days restriction. And what days restriction is, you wake up at 5:45 every morning in a perfect uniform, and you head down to muster in main office. And you do that five other times.
So muster, for people that don't know any naval terms, muster is whenever you get together, basically like formation where accountability happens, where you basically it's like taking roll whenever you're in fifth grade.
Right, exactly. But you're not just taking roll with your teacher. You're taking it with some pretty angry chief or senior chief or even a gunny. So it's very serious. They take it really seriously. So if you have one little hair on your uniform, that day does not count.
Ooh.
But you still have to go to the rest of the musters that day.
Ooh, and speaking from experience, we will always find something wrong with your uniform.
Oh, like, I have never had a perfect uniform just for that reason.
Yeah, and you're like, but, it could be like the smallest thing. Like, do you guys call them at the Naval Academy? You call them Irish pennants?
Yep, IPs.
Yep, Irish pennant, man.
What's that?
I feel like now it's not a politically correct term. Are you allowed to use that term anymore? Have you heard that?
I mean, I know what Irish pennant is, but everybody just calls them IP.
Yeah, you call it IP. So, like,
a lot of people actually know what it's called, an Irish pennant.
Yeah, so, for example, if you're on your shirt, like on your long sleeve shirt, if there's a little string hanging off like this right here, I'm showing Connor, so this is good damn radio. So in the seam of your long sleeve shirt where you have like a little bit of thread poking out, if it's not exactly flush, that's an Irish pennant. That's a ding on your uniform.
Oh, yeah. No, sure. We just call it something different. Someone might say, like, mm-hmm. Oh, you going to go rappel from that later?
Yeah. That's a common insult, too.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you got it. Keep going. So you go. Right, you get down to mustard.
Yeah, so you do that 5 times a day, and on your second to last one, it's right after chow or evening meal. So it is around 1800. So right after, or 1845, actually. So you go after dinner, and you have to march tours with your rifle that's from World War One, probably, because it weighs like 50 pounds. You're marching around T Court, which is just in the back of the dorms, in a square for about an hour or so.
That sounds awful.
In the winter?
I mean, that's college. And, like, that's what people don't really realize, I think, about when we were talking about these guys. You chose to go to this college. I mean, granted, not a lot of schools have an entry-level position where they're going to pay you as well as an O-1 or a brand-new officer gets paid. But that's your college life. When normal college students, after dinner, they're going to get fucked up, your dumbass has an M1 Garand and you're marching around to get rid of some of your hours.
Yep, exactly.
So we've talked a lot about the academies, and I think the Naval Academy and West Point, very different, but also a lot of similarities, like the type of discipline that you're going to go through. So you're in flight school right now, right?
Correct.
How's that going?
It's going all right. Can't complain.
So have you actually gotten to fly yet?
Yes. So right now I'm in what's called IFS. That's the very first thing that you do.
What's that acronym?
I'm sorry?
What is that acronym? What's ISS?
IFS is initial flight screening.
Okay.
Okay. So you're doing a lot of like physicals and shit.
Not really. So that's like as soon as you check into the command, you're going to get all that stuff. You're going to get going to the flight cert to get your up shit. You're going to get all your records in order and then get your physicals and everything like that. But what IFS is, you get dished out to like a civilian flying school, pretty much. So I'm over at Pensacola International Airport learning how to fly a little Cessna.
What's that, like just a little plane? So everybody starts on little planes, right?
Yeah, very small, very small. Like single propeller. It's what you would imagine flying over Alaska on a fishing trip, and if that makes any sense.
Yo, yeah, I love Alaska shows. Big Alaska show guy. Whenever you get there, so your difference is you went straight from the Naval Academy, and then you went to OCS, right? You don't have to go to OCS.
No, we don't have to go from OCS. Our graduation is also our commissioning.
Okay, and then from that, where do you go? Right to where you're at right now?
So sometimes it depends on what your report date is. So after everybody selects pilot or naval flight officer, they get together a couple months later, and it goes by order of merit, and you get to pick your days that you report, the day that you report down here to Pensacola. So I reported September 16th, which I was happy about. The last people to pick got July 1st. And a lot of people didn't really want that because they wanted to get as much time in, just take leave.
So if you go to September, basically when you graduated in May?
Yes.
So you have 3 months off. So you have like a legit
three months. We get a free 30 days called graduation leave.
Okay.
But then you come back to Annapolis and you are TADing.
Okay.
So you just have like a temporary job. And I was one of the Cleve summer sailing instructors.
Oh, that sounds like a nice little job.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad at all, especially in the town of Annapolis.
It gets old quick.
Yeah, throw a little boat shoes on.
Yeah.
Have a little champagne with the kids. sounds wonderful.
Hey, so Pat, I mean, you know, I can, you know, relate, but, you know, our listeners, I think they find it interesting. Talk a little bit about what are some of the things that one might get demerits for that would probably surprise people at any other university or college that they would think, oh, my God, you got in trouble for that? where they might have done that like every day?
So the one thing that I got in trouble for the most from my senior enlisted leader, from my staff sergeant, was not having a organized desk. I'm not a very organized person at all, so that was very difficult for me to wake up in the morning, get my uniform right, make sure I was shaved and all that stuff, and then worry about my desk. No, like, it never happened. So I got in trouble for that quite a few times.
And I don't think people realize the meticulous nature of what it's like. So kind of explain how meticulous they are about what a dirty desk is to somebody who's never been through like a Marine Corps field day inspection or the inspection like you guys would have at school. They don't understand that.
Right. So every once a semester we have to have an alpha inspection. That's like your room has to be spotless, just in pristine condition. So
like white glove, right? Like white glove where they put on a glove and you're like going through any crease in the room, like into the corner, like above the windowsill. Every inch of the room has got to be completely
spotless.
Every nook
and cranny. So when the inspector comes in, you have to have a ruler on your desk, a pen, a grading sheet, a black glove, and a black sock and a white glove. And they're all used for different reasons and to check. They like the biggest thing, they check on the top of the door. Like who looks on the top of a door?
Gunny's like, nope. That's hard. Yeah. Chiefs, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a great place for dust to hide.
Yeah.
Oh, it really is.
And really, like, did they ever tell you while you're going through what the reasoning was behind the meticulous checks?
I mean, I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now. Now that I've like been here a little bit and I am around a lot of enlisted sailors and Marines, but it's just taking pride in your environment and making sure that you're setting an example.
I always told my Marines that it was always about, I always told my guys that it was always about incredible attention to detail, that I want you to be exactly,
right. Okay.
If I tell you to do something, if I want you to clean your room, I don't want you to do it half-assed. If I say to you, clean your room, it needs to be done perfectly. Everything that I want you to do, you do it instantly, willingly, and with obedience to the finest letter of the law.
Yeah, I mean, Pat, as you go in your military career, it'll become more prevalent why you did these things, and it's also it's a matter of discipline, because especially like when you're in combat, you can't just kind of. Well, I guess I was an artillery officer, so sometimes we could be close enough and we'd still get our job done. But you know, everything is done for a very particular reason, and you need to understand how to execute orders precisely. And that's, you know, it may seem stupid. Why do I have to make my bed this way? Why does this have to be?
Absolutely.
And like, a lot of it is stupid.
Oh, it, yeah,
a
it
lot
is
of
stupid.
It is really fucking dumb.
Yeah.
Like that idea that your uniform looks like shit if you have one Irish pennant is banana land.
Yeah.
Like it's just not true.
Like our
nobody
socks,
notices it.
Our socks in our drawer, they used to say your socks have to smile. And there was such a way to fold them.
I remember that.
Yeah, such a way to fold them that it looked like your sock was smiling, and it's like, well, that's ridiculous.
Same thing with your rack. It has to be at an exact 45-degree angle, not 47, not 49, 45.
Yeah, it's that attention to detail that, you know, when you're in combat, there are certain things that you cannot be, you know, half-assed on. You have to be very precise, and you have to execute just so. And that's what all these things they teach you in that discipline, and it bleeds into other portions of your life. Like, if I say, you know, we're SPing for a mission at 0800. You know, that doesn't mean you're strolling in at 0759 and 45 seconds, you know.
No, you're 15, 20 minutes early.
Exactly.
And none of these things are things that you haven't heard a million times, and every single military dude listening hasn't heard a million times. What are you looking forward to about being a pilot?
Pat, what are you going to fly?
To answer your question first, so I won't know what I'm flying until I get to primary, which is after – that's probably in about a year or so. So, and also I don't really know what I want to fly. I'm just happy to be up there, man.
You're just
it
happy to get
really
aviation?
A thrill.
So the aviation side, so does your five-year obligation start when you reach the fleet and you do all your shit?
Yeah, so my clock does not start when I graduate. It starts when I get my wings. So when I get pinned and officially become an aviator, that's when my time starts.
So your 5 years is really going to end up being like 7.
It's usually around 8 or 9.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually that's true of aviators that go to West Point as well.
But it's good because your ass would be at Southwest Airlines in a heartbeat, right? Like, you're going to get those $130,000, $140,000 checks and you're going to be like, yeah, man, I think I would much rather fly the Flying Skies back and forth from Orlando to Fort Lauderdale every day than doing this bullshit.
Absolutely. Yeah, they actually just, I think they're starting to throw some really big, like, signing bonuses if you stay in the Navy.
Yeah, which they, I mean, they have to, and they do that with all the guys that are, guys and girls that are doctors and pediatricians, they have to. Mm-hmm. Like, they give the surgeons bonuses quarterly, because you otherwise, why would you stay in a job that makes $100,000 a year when you can go easily make $200,000, $300,000 a year on the outside?
And it'll be interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, in recent years, there's been some drawdowns in certain branches of our military and certain positions, but with the new administration, that might change a little bit. So you might see, I don't know, maybe some of those bonuses are going away and people just have to stay because they can't get out early anymore. So we'll see what happens.
Right.
Do you wake up excited to go fly every day?
I do. It really is, like, amazing. Just the view up there and knowing that you're controlling everything going on around you is just, it's exhilarating.
Oh, I bet. And looking forward to it, because I'm sure if you're like Connor School, where you kind of find out that you got the aviation side at year three, like the end of year three, so you were pretty stoked and you're looking forward to it for a year. I'm sure it's probably been in the back of your mind the entire time you're at the Naval Academy, too, working hard to get that spot.
Oh, absolutely. We actually find out a week before Thanksgiving break our senior year.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah.
It's the same. Yeah, it's the same for
us.
That's
what everybody finds out.
Yeah, that's
so you got to really, especially aviation, you know you really have to work your ass off because so many people there want that spot.
Yeah, a lot of people definitely do. It's usually split. A lot of people, well, obviously, all the hardos really want to go special warfare, like EOD and SEALs. Then only 30 of them get it, so where are they going to go? Like, they're either going to go Marine ground or they're going to try to fly.
Nice. And so can you do flight school for Marine side, too? Can you say, I want to be green side pilot?
Yep, absolutely. One of my good friends, shout out to my friend Austin.
Shout out to Austin.
He went to TBS right after graduating. And then
TBS is the basic school?
Yep, basic school, and he is down here right now. He's in primary. He should be still. He finds out what platform he'll be flying in a couple weeks now.
Sweet. Well, are you excited? You're probably going to be on the week after the Navy Army game. So, let's get a prediction from you. What do you think? Ooh. What do you think the game is going to look like? What do you think the score is going to be like? And you're either going to be incredibly wrong 10 days after, or you're going to look like a genius.
All right. So,
and then when you're done with your prediction, you know, I have a question. I want you to expound on Chaps's question, but what were you involved in when you were in school?
So I was actually on the baseball team. I was a recruited baseball player.
Okay. So you're on the baseball team. So you were still, you were going Army, Navy, you're sitting in the stands. So after you give your prediction, just talk a little bit about what it's like going to the Army, Navy game as a midshipman. And it's, you know, very similar as cadet, but just talk about that a little bit.
Okay. So for what I think, how the game is going to go, if you asked me this at the beginning of the year, I thought this was going to be the year that the streak was snapped. But how we've been playing, I feel like we have a really good chance of pulling this one out. So I'm gonna go with 21-14. Maybe.
Okay. And you're not concerned that the quarterback and running back are out?
I am, but I have faith in my boys.
There it is. Love it. Love it. All right.
But yeah, so going to the Army-Navy games, honestly, every American should go. It is the most it's an experience. It really is. So because my dad, he graduated from the academy in 81, and he just every single year we were huddled around the TV watching Army-Navy game. Everything else stopped. So I was a huge fan going into it. My first one, we won. I think it was on a last-second touchdown pass from Keenan Reynolds, but it truly is an experience. So everybody on the baseball team would sit with the other guys on the cross team and the wrestling team. We called it the pit, and everybody just went bonkers in there. We stormed there to get the front row seats, and it is honestly like an SEC football game. If you're there, it's so much fun. Like I don't even have the words to describe it.
Yeah, man. Like, we can't wait. Like, at this point, we'll be removed from it. I'm sure we'll have a little recap. But just wanted to say thank you for reaching out and thank you for your service, man. You're a young guy doing things. You are obviously a smart, intelligent dude. You could have done anything with your life, and you chose to serve your nation, and we really appreciate that. Me as an old retired Marine dude and Cons as an old crusty captain that got out too, we appreciate your service and what you're doing.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for your service, and hopefully I'll hear from you again.
All right, Semper Fi.
Thanks, Pat. Beat Navy.
Beat Army.
Well, thanks again for Pat for coming on and doing that interview. And it was a little bit late, but that's okay. Shit happens. All right, so the next section of Zero Block 30 is going to be brought to you by our good friends at SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest and easiest way to find tickets for the football games you want to see up close and in person this season. There's nothing like being in the stadium for the biggest plays of the biggest year. With SeatGeek, it's never been easier to get guaranteed seats that you want for a great value. I have SeatGeek back on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and just with a few taps, I can instantly find seats for this week's sporting events or any type of game. With SeatGeek, you can always find the best deal on every ticket because SeatGeek price compares for you by searching multiple ticket sites. Prices can vary depending on where you shop, but SeatGeek, you can always find the lowest available price. And SeatGeek's wanting to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see the underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Plus, every ticket you can buy on SeatGeek is backed by their 100% guarantee, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. All you have to do to get $20 back on your very first purchase is go to SeatGeek, download the app, go to the settings tab, and click add a promo, enter the promo code CHAPS, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Download SeatGeek app, enter the promo code CHAPS, and you'll get $20 back on your first purchase. All right. So this week, we had a question on Twitter, and I thought it was a fucking phenomenal question.
Okay, let's do it.
This guy asked me, a buddy told me, that they used to smoke dried out dip that was rolled in toilet paper in Afghanistan, and they called it Siga dips. Do we think that he's pulling his leg? Connor, what do you think?
I will say I never firsthand saw anyone do that, but I do not think he's pulling our leg because, one, and we've said it because folks have asked us time and again, what should we send soldiers? And first answer I always give is tobacco, because it's so tough to get over there in some places. And then even when they do, a lot of times it's dried out. So between the lack of resources and the ingenuity of soldiers who are really fiending for a cigarette or a dip, I totally believe that.
Oh, I 100% believe it, especially if I knew the location that he was in.
Yeah.
If they were at a large FOB, a large forward operating base, I would say no.
Yeah.
If they're at a smaller place that hadn't had any deliveries for a while, and guys who are used to smoking a ton, like when you're on watch during the daytime, I wasn't a smoker before I went to Iraq. I used to constantly smoke there just to stay awake because I was tired all the time. Like if I had day, because I was used to doing missions at night.
Yep.
So if it was a daytime watch, I would be smoking like all day long. So I 100% believe that they smoked out, dried out dip. The toilet paper thing is barbaric. Usually you hear I know it's probably going to bother some listeners, Bible. Like I've heard a lot, like the little pocket Bibles, that was pretty popular to do.
Yep. Anything that would be more durable than just pure toilet paper. But yeah.
And the little Bibles kind of look like rolling paper anyway.
Absolutely. That's exactly the same material and feel of rolling papers.
That's what I was thinking. They're like identical, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
They're pretty damn close. I mean, I don't think that toilet paper would work.
No, I think it would burn too fast.
It could be because it's like not even single ply. It's like quarter ply toilet paper. Like it's crazy thin. So that it's basically like the same material that you put over the seat at a doctor's office. So I could see possibly that would work.
Yeah, but you can never doubt the ingenuity of soldiers who are deployed who just need that fix. Like Chaps was saying, like he needed that because that's what he got used to stay awake was smoking. You know, some people it's 9 cups of coffee a day, whatever. People find their vices, they find their routines, and they have to stick to them. And I'd imagine that's like, you know, like what a drug addict feels like when they're just in a real bad place. They do just about anything to get their fix.
Now, if his leadership found him drying out dip and smoking, it would create a nickname situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No doubt. Because a lot of times in the military, you have these guys that will get these nicknames that will stick around for fucking ever. Absolutely. And I was thinking about one this week, and I'll let you go first. Riggsy, if you have any good hockey nicknames or school nicknames, you could throw those in too. I'm sure, given the propensity people have to make comments about your handsome eyes, you've gotten some good ones over the years, Riggsy.
Well, what people have to realize is that the first four letters of my last name are B-O-Z-O, so I've always been Bozo.
Yeah.
Or Bose, or some version of that.
I mean, your name is built for nicknames.
Right, and so it's really, the eyes really didn't take over until Barstool, because people didn't know my real last name, which kind of trumps everything else in terms of nickname.
Yeah, and I feel like the hockey community is really good at giving nicknames. You just throw a Y on the end of everything. And
yeah, it's
really
big, but I was also going to say the same thing about the military. I feel like you guys are constantly on the prowl looking for, like, oh, that's a great nickname opportunity for that guy.
Yeah, but the way it comes about organically, the way Chaps mentioned it, like, for me, I was trying to
think... And the fact that my name is Chaps, like, that's part of it. Like, yeah. I mean...
But here's my question about
my whole life now.
Here's my question about Chaps is that, didn't you give yourself that?
It was kind of like a group effort. So we had, there was another dude that we named Jesus Christmas, because he was like a Mexican dude who was like the whitest guy ever. He basically dressed like Connor. So
we made I'm going to try to take that as a compliment.
Yeah, you're fine. I mean, you're white.
So he was, I mean, all of us had nicknames. It was basically a group of like six that came up with nicknames together. And so mine just kind of stuck. Connor, do you have any good nickname buddies?
The best one I could think of off the top of my head, and I was racking my brain yesterday trying to think of something, but the best one I thought came up with was the one that my soldiers called me. One time I was showing them pictures of something. Maybe it was my house at Christmas time or something to the effect of they thought I grew up in some sort of privilege. Now, you know, I grew up middle class, whatever, very nice upbringing, but nothing over the top, nothing fancy. Couple that with the West Point education. They're like, oh, look at this guy freaking coming with a silver spoon in his mouth. And then before you know it, I'm LT Spoon. Just the rest of my deployment, LT Spoon.
So ooh, that's rough.
Yeah, it was.
And I know that bothers you.
Yeah.
That one bothered you.
It did. But I mean, obviously, one, you're not going to let them know that it bothers you.
Yeah, but your face, you can read your face like a book, dude. Like, you acted like you could be covert about your emotions. It's outrageous. If anybody spent longer than 10 minutes, you know, that's bubbling to the surface at some point.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no matter what, that's coming out.
Yeah. But I mean, then you just get used to it and you don't even think twice about it. You just say, oh, LT Spoon, you turn your head and you're like, oh, okay, that's me now. Whatever.
So a bunch of my, there's a dude that I used to work with in Okinawa, and he was a former drill instructor. And he couldn't remember anybody's name, which is kind of like me. I don't remember people's names either. It takes me a long time to remember their name. So he would just basically pick out something that you were doing and call you it.
Yeah.
Or see something about you and call you it. Like if you had big ears, he'd be like, hey, big ears. Well, one time we were doing this for like homeless people in Okinawa. We were doing like a give back turkey, whatever. And this dude was in there with hot dishes, like doing the dishes afterwards, and he was supposed to be hurrying up, but he was taking fucking forever to do it. So this guy walks in and everybody else is like waiting in formation outside because they're done with their task, and he's the only one not done with the dishes. So he walks in there and we all come in, like all the other sergeants and corporals are in there too, and he's like, hey there, fucking kitchen gloves. And he, this dude, still, man, still, when I see people on Facebook that are like mutual friends, people still will be like, happy birthday, kitchen gloves. It's fucking 9 years later, dude.
Yeah,
it's
still
though. Called kitchen gloves.
Yeah, that's a good one, though.
Yeah, and it adds, like, when you have a good story like that behind the nickname, that's never going to leave. That's the best
but it's
part
not
of the
even, game. But if you're telling your friends, like, why does everybody that you're in the military with call you kitchen gloves? They're expecting a better story than, well, one time I was washing dishes, and that's essentially the story.
Yeah, but it's
like
much...
That's it.
It's much better, like, when other people tell it about you than you saying, like, oh, this is how I got my nickname. I feel like it's always like that.
Yeah.
No, like, for the longtime Barstool readers, like, that Weird Haircut Seth still is called Weird Haircut Seth.
Well, tell them about what Gaz told us when we were heading down to Baltimore about Weird Haircut Seth.
I don't want to get into it because I think that's a very niche thing that a lot, if you're not like a long Barstool reader, you won't remember.
All right. Well, the crux of it is the guy has since long gone since Barstool has moved on to another job, and his people at his new job call him Weird Haircut Seth. It's unbelievable. A good nickname will stick with you forever.
Yeah. It's
and nice. Guys in the military, man, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because you go through a lot of hardship and you go through a lot of tumultuous times together that you just form a bond that you feel comfortable with the folks that are around you. So I feel like ball busting and humor gets taken up a notch. I've always have found that more often than not, especially senior NCOs are just very funny people. Would you agree with that?
I would 100% agree with that.
Yeah. It's just, it's something about you pin on that sergeant's rank, that E5, and you just,
well,
add probably humor.
You've been absorbing a lot of those jokes for years, and now you can just kind of recycle them. Like, that's why some of the insults are the same. They're just recycled.
Yeah, but it works.
So moving on from that, this week in history, in 1946, the United Nations General Assembly voted to establish the UN headquarters in New York City, and the UN adopted a disarmament resolution prohibiting the A-bomb. And that was because in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, over 400,000 people were killed when the two bombs were dropped. This week, we're going to shift into Aleppo. Aleppo has been all over the news, but a lot of people still don't know about it. So we kind of wanted to give you our spin on it because at current count, and correct me if I'm wrong, Riggs, they have expected that 450,000 people have been killed in Aleppo.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to hone in. Some have it at over 500,000, but it's at least 450, maybe up close to 600,000.
It's a lot, no matter how you shake
which
it.
Which is a ton of people.
So kind of walk us through, if you haven't heard anything about Aleppo and you haven't been following the news at all, because it can be daunting. There's situations going all over the world. Russia's big in the news right now. China was just flying a nuclear airplane over the South Korean Sea. There's so many things going on in the world. Boko Haram is destroying people in the northern parts of Africa. So Aleppo, if you haven't been paying attention or you have so much sad news in 2016 just in our own country and kind of had your head in the sand, Riggsy, as our journalist, walk us through what's happening in Aleppo.
Yeah, so, you know, we've come in here and we've talked through a lot of different issues where we just kind of more shoot the shit about it. I think Aleppo is such a serious, intense thing that's even reached another level from what we usually talk about, that I thought the best way to do it is to, and I've been on a little bit of a history kick, is to kind of go back a little bit and give people the full background of how we got here. And the only real way to do that is to go all the way back to 2010, 2011, which is the Arab Spring. And so people understand the Arab Spring began and originated in Tunisia, basically in December 2010. It quickly spread to other Arab regions like Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and eventually in 2011 in Syria. Now, the Arab Spring, is kind of going to be the theme of this whole story, is wildly complicated. There's all kinds of different sides inflicting, all kinds of different damage. There's different alliances. And the best way I'd say to characterize it are just democratic uprisings all across the Arab world, essentially against authoritarian and kind of autocratic regimes that had dominated the Arab world for a very long time. So in Syria, basically during the time of the Arab Spring, President Bashar al-Assad, who is widely disliked and was at the time, his kind of the discontent for him, along with the Arab Spring and all these different uprisings across the Arab world, really reached a boiling point, and protests erupted all across Syria over 2011 to the point where on March 23rd, 2011, more than 20 people were killed in the southwestern city of Daraa. On April 8th, at least 35 people were killed, and these people were killed. These are protesters killed by government forces, by Syrian government forces, shooting into protests. Obviously, this pissed off everyone across the world, across the democratic world. Where you can peacefully protest, people hated this. And a year later, we get into kind of mid-2012, Syria has erupted into full-out civil war. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of different rebel groups Some of them are backed by the U.S. Some of them are extremist. Some of them are a little bit more democratic and what we would consider normal. And then there's the Assad regime, which is obviously backed by everything that a massive military and government like Syria would have. That went on for several years. And if you fast forward to kind of September 2015, you look at when Russia formally or officially or directly got involved and sort of, directly backed the Assad regime and kind of masked it, according to some people. I want to be as objective as possible. They masked it as, you know, we're here to eliminate ISIS and to help Syria eliminate ISIS. What happened here and the reason that we're in such a humanitarian crisis is that the western part of Aleppo is controlled by the Syrian government, by Assad, and that they were able to kind of fortify that control thanks to help from Russia. They also got help from Iran. The eastern part has been kind of a massive disaster, and that's the part where the rebels, who the U.S. has backed along with a couple other Arab nations like Saudi Arabia, have helped out. We've backed, we've armed them essentially because we kind of took a stand against Assad. And if you go back again to 2013, Assad is accused and the UN confirmed that he used chemical weapons to kill thousands of civilians along with rebels. So there's a lot going on here, and it's clearly extremely complicated. The reason that we're at such a humanitarian crisis right now is because the strategy from Assad and from the Syrian regime was to basically, siege eastern Aleppo. And what happens has gone on all through history. I mean, if you look at the siege of Rome by the Visigoths in 410, if you look at, the siege of Boston even, when the Continental Army was able to take Dorchester Heights and essentially force the British out of Boston. The whole goal here, right, is to surround, dry out these places from all the supplies, everything that they have inside of it, and wait them out, basically. And what that does, it starves everyone. They can't get food. They can't get medical supplies. They can't get water. And eventually, the people in there, whether they're with the rebels or not, they start to get fed up. They start to get hungry. They start to eventually turn on everybody and everything that they know and say, we got to get the hell out of here. And that is basically the point that we've reached. And the reason that a lot of humanitarians are very pissed off is because humanitarian groups that have no allegiance to either side have said, look, we need to get supplies in there because there were 200-something thousand people there. A lot have gotten out, but there's still an estimated 50 to 100,000 civilians in eastern Aleppo. People are saying, let us get them supplies. We're not here to kill anybody. We're not here to pick a side. They just need supplies. Obviously, that doesn't help Assad's goal of the siege, of cutting everybody off and forcing them out. And now we've reached the point where so many people have died. They've essentially cornered the rebels into about five small neighborhoods in eastern Aleppo. And we're at the point where civilians are reportedly being executed. 82, I believe, is the report from Monday. There's been a ceasefire. The ceasefire has been broken. So we've reached the boiling point. We've kind of reached the point where a siege is supposed to force, eventually force an outcome and a result. The Syrian regime is claiming that result is that they've won, that they've regained control in eastern Aleppo. And now we're in a situation where the U.S. is involved, Russia's involved. Do we want to get into a conflict with Russia? Do our planes in the sky want to get into a conflict with their planes in the sky? And all of a sudden, we've got two global nuclear superpowers going against each other. So it's incredibly complicated. That's where we're at. And again, because 500-something thousand people have died, 50,000 of those are children, it's kind of jumped to the forefront of national and international news, and for good reason, I think.
So, Riggs, everything you just said is why it is so incredibly complicated, because there are so many different ways to approach this scenario. There is the humanitarian point that you made. There is the military point that you made. There is the political implications that will stem from how the world and specifically the U.S. reacts, because don't forget, we just had an election. We got a new president coming in. There's transition. I don't know how much President Obama is going to get involved, how deep involved he's going to get into this, or how deep involved President-elect Trump has started to get involved in this. So, I mean, there's a few points right there that it's unbelievably complicated, especially also, too, because you have so many different countries that are getting involved here, and they're countries that have a lot of implications around the world. So, I mean, it's just so much for me to wrap my brain around. Chaps, I don't even know. Where do you want to start?
I'll start with a fact and just ask what you think, Riggs. In my opinion, everything that's happening in Syria and happening in Aleppo, especially on the Russian front and our front and the Iranian front, they are using people as a position to posture themselves as a different type of global power at this point. Would you agree with that?
100%. And they're very good at it, which sucks. And the main loser by far are the people, the civilians. And I think the first show I was ever on, you know, we talked about Mosul, and the biggest takeaway is that these are just people that were born there. They're not much different than you or I. They love their family. They like to just carry on with their business, do what they love to do, whatever, just survive, live within their culture. They're very normal people that were born into this area who they don't know where the hell to go. I mean, what do? You get they're bombarding the city with airstrikes, bombs. They're being cut off. They can't get supplies. There are hundreds of thousands of people that are just trapped in the middle, and it has nothing to do with them, yet everyone's using them to sway public opinion, to deter people from attacking, et cetera, which makes it infinitely more complicated.
And it seems like every few days you hear a different position on what's going on with the ceasefire. There's a ceasefire here, there. Yeah. But then you see these tweets. Like I saw one this morning that I was watching a video, and it's children at an orphanage that were talking about how all of their parents are dead and they soon will be too because of what's going on in Aleppo. Like it's absolutely heartbreaking, and it feels like it's almost fake. Like we've seen so many countries destroyed in the last 5 years, completely destroyed, entire groups of people really wiped out, like cultures wiped out by different areas of strongholds all throughout the Middle East, all throughout Northern Africa, all throughout the world, really. There's hundreds of thousands of people that are in concentration camp type situations in North Korea. And we sit here as Americans, and it's hard to really wrap your idea around, your head around it. And I thought this week, really for the first time, like whenever, like kind of transitioning, but not really, into what's going on with Russia, I feel like not that many Americans care, because we have been taught since we were young, especially our generation and the generation of our parents, that Americans are so superior to every other country in the world in so many ways that nothing really bad is ever going to happen on our soil. And you can feel the global climate if you're looking at it. Is that starting to shift some?
Like, I think it has to be. I mean, look what happened.
Looking at Russia fucking with our elections, were the elections valid? Were they 100% the votes that were casted? Yes. Was propaganda placed out there by the Russian government? All 17 of the intelligence agencies say yes, but the president-elect is saying he's not sure. Like, that is different from American policy than maybe in history.
Yeah, no, you're right. There are certainly implications that will stem from Russia being involved in this whole scenario. And I mean, you could, like I said, you could go delve into that that tangent of it. But I think what is really, it's what you said, Chaps. It's heartbreaking that we see, because like you said, we don't know what that's like to have bombings and things of that nature on a daily basis. Granted, we've had some horrific things happen in the last 5-10 years on our soil that really have sucked, that have stemmed from terrorist actions. But to be consistently bombed and bombarded, that is not a world that we know. And I think it's so tough for people in the United States to wrap their brain around it, because their instinct is, we have to go help. And it's so difficult because it's, we can't just, okay, we'll go help and just show up over there.
And another thing that really makes it very tough is misinformation. And
yeah,
what people have to understand is that Syria very historically has a tight control over information that gets in, information that gets out, how it gets out. It's state-run media. And so there's all sorts of propaganda against Assad and the Syrian forces, propaganda for the rebels, propaganda against the rebels. And people have to understand, beyond that, you know, some of these rebels are extremists. Some of them, if they were victorious, might end up just like ISIS. Some of them are good. And so if you're backing some of them because you decide that the greater of all the evils is Assad, then you have to figure out, you know, what are we going to do after that? And how are these people you know, how are these groups treating the people, and how are they adding to the humanitarian crisis? So there's just so many different elements to it, and it's really tough for people to make an educated or to form an educated opinion on what's going on when you can't get the information. And even the mainstream media outlets have said, you know, we don't really have people on the ground. A, it's dangerous, and B, we just can't get them there, so then they're relying on other people for information. So it's really tough.
So we're getting a lot of misinformation, and what you said about, all right, if we want to send military aid and back those rebels with our troops, that's so complicated to ramp someone up to deploy units over there, and then that's not something you just show up for a week, help out, and go home. You have to maintain a presence there for a long time. It's not that easy.
You have to decide who to give it to as well, and then you have to be able to justify why you gave it to them if they do really bad shit down the line.
Absolutely. So my point is that I want to help. As the United States, we do have the resources to help, but we have to be smart about it. And the biggest thing, I think, is that it's really shitty timing for the United States with the transition we're going through politically.
Yeah, I don't think that there's ever really a good timing, but I just don't know what you do. And I think that that's the best thing that can come out of this, is that it is an incredibly complicated issue. But this is it's a dangerous time to be a citizen of the world. Really, it is. And that sounds so silly. And based on everything that we've been taught for the first 30 years, really, of my life, that Americans are going to be better than everybody else. But whenever you have things that are going on like they are right now, it's kind of a wake-up call. And seeing children carried out on stretchers, put in pine boxes, oftentimes left in the streets just to rot. Like, Aleppo is fucking horrifying. And it's horrifying to a degree that probably, I would say, 85% of Americans don't even really give a shit about what's happening in Aleppo.
And they need to give a shit, because it could get to a point where it starts to affect us at home. If we get into a freaking conflict with Russia, who knows what could happen? You know, you got two nations in the world that have
Russia, China, Iran, South Korea, Japan. All of them are fucking pissed.
All the big
right
players,
now.
Like, all the people who have
world powers are pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, Chaps, I thought you made a really good point in that, you know, are we X amount superior, or are we superior at all? And we all kind of grew up with that. But I feel like we're kind of entering a new age, right? I mean, if you look at the beginning of kind of World War One, all the way up until the last few years, it was, you know, if you had X amount of military dominance through sheer force, you dominated. You were the best. People couldn't really fuck with you. I mean, people couldn't mess with me in the United States of America, because the U.S. military was so dominant. How the hell are you going to be able to get here? Now there's so many different ways to do it, whether it's terrorism, whether it's cyber hacking, and how that can mess up lives and kind of mess with either the financial system or our military systems, or how all messing with any of those trickles down and screws with the rest of the system. So it is the fact that, you know, the Russian hacking of the election, and the fact that it looks like they were successful and they had some kind of impact, whether that tilted the scales or not, it's very alarming, and it's different than anything we've ever kind of known, I feel like.
It's a wake-up call. Hey, people, pay attention to what's going on in Aleppo, because the ramifications are going to be felt for a while, and they're going to be far and wide. So, people, pay attention to what's going on in Aleppo.
And we're past the point where your geolocation and technological advances are that much superior than everybody else in the world.
Yep.
We've been basically isolated because of where North America really is. Now, so many countries have really the technology and the armament to reach out and touch us, too. So it's not like just because you're sitting somewhere in Kansas that you're untouchable like you were for the first 250 years of our republic. It's not the same anymore. You can be reached out and touched, too. It's an important issue. Pay attention to what's happened with Russia. Like, it's just big issues. But we're not going to solve it on Zero Block 30, but I know a lot of people wanted our thoughts on Aleppo. It's not like General Mattis is going to be showing up at my house in San Antonio and be like, "Hey, Chapsy, let's grab a beer.
Come on in. I need to talk to you about this.
You CBT guys. Yeah. Can't wait to get called down to Washington.
Right. We want our listeners to be aware as little as we are aware, because we're not the intelligence community. We only know what's posted. Riggs only knows basically what's posted on BBC and the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other reputable places. But we aren't on the ground. We aren't boots on the ground. And that's why listening to your intelligence briefing, if you're listening, Mr. President-elect, listen to your fucking intelligence briefings every day.
Yep.
Yeah. Not pawn them off on the vice president.
That was a ridiculous statement. You could be the smartest person in the world, but these guys are paying attention to news reports and intelligence reports from all over the world. You could be smart. You're not a mind reader. You don't just like telepathically know what's going on in the world. So, Donnie, pay attention.
Yeah, I look at kind of the whole the briefing idea really as like a pretty big chunk of what I do here, which is like I'm not trying to sway everybody's opinion. I genuinely just want people to understand the background of things and understand the reality of it. And then, yes, of course, like the nature of the show is we're going to talk about stuff and weigh in a little bit of our opinions, which is great. But I think that people should mostly form their own opinions based on the facts that we give. And that's the same thing with the briefings, right? Like you need the information, you need the facts to be able to make a decision from there.
Yeah, you need the information.
And that's why it's hard to brief people on Aleppo because the situation is constantly fluid. If there's a war going on, if there's people, atrocities like that going on, the situation changes every day.
Yeah.
So saying that update me when the situation changes.
Well, I got to tell you every day.
That's every day.
Yeah.
That's every day.
Yeah.
Like there's a reason why you have an S2 brief, even on a battalion level, company level, an S2 and intelligence briefing every single morning. When your primary focus as the president of the United States is being commander in chief, that's your number one job. You've got to at least listen.
Yeah, and I was, just to speak to the fluidity of it, yesterday I was writing the blog on Aleppo and how there had been a ceasefire. And as I was writing it, the ceasefire was broken.
Yeah.
Like, as it was happening.
And I don't even care if he's briefed in person. I don't even care if that's the case.
Yeah.
You got to read it. Yeah, read the intelligence briefing. If you don't, but you're going over pages and pages and pages instead of getting the summary, just read it.
I think he'll learn, or at least I hope he learns.
Donald, read the fucking briefing, please.
Yeah, Don, we know you listen to ZBT. Read your briefings.
If you don't read the briefing, at least click on barstoolsports.com and, and read some of our shit.
Yeah. Also, Saturday nights, midnight, 0:30.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't think we can ever really get to the bottom of that, and I hope that this situation is resolved, but it just doesn't feel like it's going to be one that's going to be resolved forever. And I don't really know where you go from here, and that's just us being honest. We're not going to have the answers of what we think we should intelligently do. Connor and I have never been boots on the ground in Syria, thank God. Yeah. And I don't want any of our boys and girls to be boots on the ground in Syria anytime soon as well. So having kind of an isolationist ideology like I do in certain areas around the world because we're so war thin, it's a hard situation to be in because do you just go to Syria? Do you go to Africa? Do you go to Korea? Where do you go? You can't go everywhere. You can't be the global police, but you also can't sit by and idly watch 500,000 people get slaughtered and not have your humanity torn at. So that's a heavy spot to end this little section of 0:30. So we're going to go into saved rounds and alibis. Connor, any saved rounds, alibis?
Yeah, so two things. I really want to thank our listeners. Our listeners have been doing such a great job. I've been getting reports of guys deployed who have been getting packages, and they're just like, hey, I listen to ZBT. These guys have said you need these things. Here's a care package, which is awesome. So thank you to anyone who has sent something to a stranger overseas. That's awesome. And I tweeted out this week some more addresses. If you want to send packages for Christmas, please continue to do so. I cannot begin to tell you how much that means to a soldier, to a Marine, to an airman, to a sailor when they get a package, especially from a stranger. It is awesome. So thank you very much to our listeners.
Riggsy?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would say when I was at when we were at Army Navy, the amount of people that came up to me and just said, you know, I 0:30 is my favorite podcast. I listen to it every day, and a good amount of them were, you know, military servicemen and women. Some of them weren't. It was kind of 50-50, and they said, you know, the perspective that that you two bring from having served is incredible. The stories that you guys say, and I said this the first show I came on. I mean, the stories are awesome, and they're so unique, and then the fact that we're able to have the type of discussion. So I want to say the same thing. Thanks. The listeners are awesome. I think that the more people can keep telling people about the show, the more people can kind of really latch onto it and find something that's very different. So thanks to the listeners.
Well, part of my take has they are award-winning listeners, and we don't want to take anything from that, but attention to orders. For all of you that have listened to the first 14 episodes, it's my privilege to give you a good conduct medal. The first ever CPT good conduct medal.
Hell yeah. So, woo! Hell yeah.
Congratulations. Woo! Go out, have a beer with your boys. Tell them about Zero Block 30. And I'm not sure if we're going to have an episode next week or not, because Christmas is coming up and we want to spend some time with our families. But if we don't, we'll see you guys soon. Thanks for listening to Zero Block 30.